This week on RSPNB Update, as 2022 comes to an end, it's time to recap the year's headline updates. With a bumper crop of quests, lore, skill, and even combat updates, 2022 did not disappoint. We'll tell you what they were and how they changed how we play RuneScape. This is RSPNB Update, episode 914, recorded Thursday, December 22nd, 2022. RuneScape's 2022 in review. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of RSBNB Update this week as we head into Christmas, head into the wonderful holiday season. We've got a year in review, 2022 RuneScape year in review episode for you. Tanis is going to be co-hosting with me along the way. Welcome aboard.
Thanks, Shane.
What we're going to do with this episode is we're going to go through all of the key areas of focus in RuneScape. We're going to talk about quests and lore. We're going to talk about skilling. We're going to round out the episode with a discussion on combat and PVM. And to do this, we're going to be moving through a series of co-hosts that we're bringing on, people that you know from the entirety of the RSVNB update year. And we're going to start off with talking with quest caping, one of our regular quests and lore contributors whenever we have quest week. Welcome, quest caping.
Hello there.
Good to have you here. And what we want to do is we just want to provide a bit of an overview of how each mini quest or item advanced the RuneScape storyline and how everything feels looking back on it from the end of the year perspective here. And I feel like we've been through an entire whirlwind of a storyline here on update this year and covering it for RuneScape. So I think with that, we just dive right in and start with Eye of Het.
Absolutely. Going back over this, it genuinely feels like a bit of a surprise that this was this year.
Yeah.
It yeah. does not feel like it. It feels like an entire game away from where we are now, hey?
Yeah, an entirely different game, different scale, which, you know, is one thing that they wanted to scratch the itch of in looking at doing story differently, which we ended the year completely different than we were. And I want to say, looking at Eye of Het, I don't think any of us foresaw where things were going to go with Eye of Het.
Absolutely not. Yeah, this still felt like the status quo of questing. Like, even though it was delivered via mini quests, which does seem to be the direction they're going in, like serialized mini quests, delivering the story in little bite-sized chunks week after week, it was also still very much the same god-based, legendary artifact-based storytelling that we have been used to for the past entire Sixth Age since 2013.
Yeah, and I feel like that storytelling lent itself to huge storylines, which had obviously huge impacts on the entire game world and the characters and our player, but at the same time, it wasn't Cook's assistant, right?
Mm-hmm.
And keep in mind that effectively from June of 2021 all the way up through January of this year, including with Eye of Het, there was almost weekly updates to the God dialogue in the Sentistan Cathedral, keeping that in mind. So in many ways, Eye of Het piggybacked off that, and that was an interesting transition about how we move from that into this mini-quest new paradigm, I guess we could say.
Absolutely, yeah, because Eye of Het 1 had the very last piece of God dialogue, and it really felt like an ending, like an absence when Eye of Het 2 dropped, Zamorax left the cathedral, the God dialogue is gone. That's it. No more, folks.
And there was that moment in Eye of Het Part 2, I think it was, where you could point the finger at somebody who might have done something in relation to, in effect, stealing the artifact. And I feel like the community pointed their finger at the wrong person with that.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think the community pointed their finger at Sarah, if we remember correctly. Right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, we did for sure. And yeah. I don't know if this is a question. I want to know what you guys think about this, but I felt with the IF Het, it was the first time a mini quest was so impactful in the story, and like having to do that before, you know, the next major, you know, part of the story moving on, it just seemed it definitely punched above its weight.
It did. And production wise on this, we started that week off with Het's Oasis, which we'll talk more about in the skilling section, but I wasn't planning on getting the quests and lore panel going for that week. I didn't think it was going to be needed, but it was needed for two weeks in a row.
Major whiplash. Surprise, you've gone from relatively low-key part one to the absolute sledgehammer of part two.
And I feel like this was also the time in this mini quest when we had Earth on the show and he coined his famous phrase, and we'll of course see if people agree with that. Zemrak did nothing wrong, right?
Oh yes, now there's some hindsight. Hindsight is 2022.
Oh boy. And looking back on this, everything is so clear at this point, right?
Mm-hmm. Because genuinely, just looking back on what Zemrak is doing now, this is setting up what he is about to become in the middle of the year, and even more so setting up the way in which the Zemrakians will build things up just to have them destroyed.
And fight their civil war. And it's an interesting foil, because if we go back to the start of the Sixth Age in 2013, there was World Event 1.
Mm-hmm.
Saradomin versus Zemrak, and Zemrak was portrayed as the evil person back then, and he didn't have his character fleshed out until Dishonor Among Thieves. And I feel like if people understood what his character was truly about, the World Event might have ended differently. But I also feel like there's just this entire realignment in Eye of Het in particular, just so quick about what Zemrak was, and seeing if they could pull any of his fans together on this.
Yeah, sort of a slotting back into place, I guess. I think Zemrak being who he is, all about major change and upheaval and injecting a shot of chaos into the world, he really is kind of a good choice of character in a meta sense for these massive changes in story direction, like the Battle of Lumbridge was, and like the major shift we've gone through this year is.
This year is?
Yes.
Yeah, so- oh, okay. I thought that was a question, but I see what you mean. The major shift this year from focusing on, in effect, that entire cosmological type storyline down to the more traditional demons of Zemrak kind of thing.
Yeah.
In Zemrak and under the city and whatnot.
Who better than Zemrak to rip down the empire and build it again from the ground up, hey?
Yeah. And, you know, with that, I'm going to throw in that Tannis' Star Wars reference. The Empire Strikes Back at some point.
Yes.
Yeah. But mini quests, huge in ramification, both in Eye of Het and later in the Civil War arc, which we'll get to. But we also have to talk about Extinction, because this was, in many ways, what at the time felt like a very abrupt ending to the Elder God Wars stuff.
Mm-hmm. At the time, no one knew that Twilight of the Gods was coming directly after it. So essentially what we had was a lot of people feeling kind of unfulfilled at the time.
Yeah, exactly. Because there was no story done about, okay, the gods are the gods still going to be here? What's going to happen to them? That sort of thing. But we got the clarification in our episode that we did with Mod Jack and Mod Shrike that the point of Extinction was to resolve the story of Saren and the eggs.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so many analogies in that story. I think we touched on them then. Do you want to recap any of them?
There's about a million and one different aspects of family drama in here.
A lot of daddy issues.
Also mummy issues.
Saren, also mummy issues, yeah.
Saren is mummy and she is an issue.
That's true.
But let's just talk about the importance of the introduction of Adrastea because that once again focuses on the family issue. Adrastea, daughter of Sarah Doman.
Yeah, she really was. I think there was actually a whole lot of confusion at the time about who she even was. There were several people who got the wrong impression from the quest and thought, who is this Hebei person, this ancient Sarah Domanist hero? Some weird confusion with the marketing there.
Right, because previously we'd only heard from her in the Everlight Mysteries, right?
Well, yes. Hebei, that was what she was introduced. Adrastea herself was a tiny, tiny footnote in lore who you can only encounter her name if you do Sliskay's endgame to a very specific route that only a very tiny percentage of players will even encounter. So most people had never heard of Adrastea, and here she is as an absolute focal point for a year of updates.
I assume you don't know what that lore route is offhand.
I do.
Okay.
Yes, so if you follow Sarah Doman and end up racing him at the end of Sliskay's endgame, then there is a mention that Zaros is holding her captive.
And once again, that all ties into family because keep in mind that people were also wondering, you know, is Zaros going to have anything to do with extinction? But we walked around the edges of Erebus, and we ventured into Erebus quite literally as the World Guardian, but there was nothing of Zaros there. He, you know, still disappeared at Battle of the Monolith and has not been part of the story ever since then, much to the chagrin of the Zaros fans out there. So we did learn a bit more about Erebus here, and we learned that, you know, that could be the future of another cosmic level storyline if they ever wanted to do something like that, find Zaros and Char and Tony, amongst others, that disappeared into the monolith. If they're still alive, we learned how dangerous it was. We saw Carapax sacrifice himself to Erebus.
That was a dramatic moment.
Yeah. And I feel like also, since we're talking about Erebus, Carapax, we have to mention the puzzle on Erebus in terms of being their first attempt at puzzles that will get easier as you progress, but for some of us, Tanis, not easy enough, right?
No, I was like, easier, huh? What? When? How? What? Yeah. Yeah, that was rough. But I made it.
You made it.
I mean, they did, you know, they did make it possible, so I should give credit where credit's due.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is nice to see constantly a focus on accessibility in the puzzles and a way to make them almost just accessible enough that almost anyone can do them.
Yeah. And I wonder with this, with the whole Erebus thing and our path that we took through there, Montjack has been very clear that he doesn't want to do cosmic level storylines again. So part of me is wondering, is this it for Zaros? Is this it for Erebus? Because you got to keep in mind, there's still unanswered questions regarding some of the stuff that we saw in the Sentistan archaeology mysteries and the Sentistan writing on the wall stuff too, I think. Touched on that very briefly. So there's still I feel like there's still an audience out there for an Erebus continued storyline, but I don't know how they do that at this point without going up to that cosmic level again.
Yeah, it's a shame because there are things introduced in this last handful of cosmic level quests that people are still invested in.
Yep.
It feels almost like there's no way back.
I'm going to say it. The quest that shall not be named. Rite of passage.
Well, got to be honest, though. I feel that is the kind of thing that could work with just its mortal stakes on another planet, you know?
Right, because we have the world gates still. So that could work.
And, I mean, you could do Erebus by, like, Zaros' journey back. You know, he went there searching for something, doesn't work out, and then it's trapped and has been trying to get back.
Well, now, right? Now, like, he can't get back because of the edicts and whatnot. are still there.
Right. But it doesn't have to be like world ending. You know what I mean? It could be
And it could in effect, and it's going to be really interesting to see what happens in Old School with this. They're getting Desert Treasure 2 this year.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, yeah.
So, yeah.
How do they approach the power creep?
How do they approach that? And maybe Zaros just goes back to the purpley shadowy haze that communicates with some of the Majorat if they're still willing to follow him after everything that's happened. So,
how do you escalate a story that it's interesting without bringing it to that level?
Exactly. And I feel like that's an interesting needle to thread because there's been this discussion about whether or not RuneScape Quest this year are becoming Marvel movies. But with that, lowering the stakes that happened in Extinction to the point where most of the gods aren't really a threat after Extinction, are they?
Mm-hmm. The lower tier gods are not dealt with yet, but essentially all the big old forces, like it was discussed around the time of Battle of the Monolith that you genuinely could not have Zaros and Saren duke it out because even though they are major opposed characters, yeah, and that is the sort of power scale you cannot have feasibly if you want your story to be still be a story.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. Makes total sense. And instead, the fight at the end of that quest resulted in us, in effect, just evading Saren's powers. And I think it was said that those powers would have killed anyone else if we weren't the World Guardian on there. And our whole plan with that was to just get enough time to let the final inhabitants of Aya evacuate and. We were saved when the eggs did eventually hatch. So, and that raises so many questions for Saren. I famously or infamously said on that episode that I'm one of the few people after this quest that actually likes Saren more.
Thanks, Shane. Yep. I haven't really seen, to be honest, anyone else of that opinion.
No.
But you do you, Shane.
I was a Saren fan until all of this. I'm like,
Yeah, I haven't really seen many that have kept being Saren fans.
I know a few.
Yeah. Hmm. After all this, we're godless from now on. From now and forever.
Finally, the godless one.
Yeah. And that's the direction we were headed, but let's also just realize that another thing that came up with this is how far would someone go to protect their family? And that was, of course, the Saren's angle of that entire quest is that when she teleports the eggs away and when we follow her through Frenisge and whatnot and then ultimately to Aya, one of the worlds where she chooses to hatch the eggs, we learn that it's not necessarily any of the mortals or the elves that she's even concerned about at this point. It's her family, who she sees as the Elder Eggs.
I guess when you put it that way, you could essentially warp the quest to be local, super powerful godmom does everything for her family.
Yeah, yeah. And that's precisely why I came out of this having a better opinion of Saren.
That's like Ma Barker, right? Like, oh, but she loved her kids. Yeah, well, they're criminals. They're going to kill everything.
Genocide is fine if you have kids.
Yeah, I mean.
So, and I feel like this could be a discussion that would go back and forth for ages in lore discords and lore chats and whatnot.
Yes.
But at the end of the day, for many, it was that moral point of no return for Saren. So, anything on Extinction that either you guys want to talk about before we move on to Twilight?
I will say there is a bit of an epilogue here in that you've got the dream of Aya, and it's this just place that you can repeatedly. You got the Iluyanka there as well.
Right.
Just living out a memory of their home. I sort of soured on that as a happy epilogue, honestly, because they're all about the tradition and the spirit of their world, and you've got just a bit of a memory that they got to carve out a space in. Hey?
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And this was, of course, from the device in the chamber in the effigy incubator room. So, Yeah, that's interesting now that you mentioned that. I wonder what other people feel on that.
Mm-hmm.
I never really explored that thought before. Anywho, Twilight of the Gods?
Oh, yeah. The surprise bonus.
Yeah, and this was, in effect, the quest that restored the edicts and sent everyone packing. Where do you want to go with this?
So, there's a few angles it takes over the course of the quest. It's kind of like a Grandmaster quest with an extra bunch of loose ends tied up, tacked onto the front. Because what I have as the first bullet point here is Broken Home 2, Demons and Dragonkin. It really kind of feels like the Mod Jack tie-up quest. Like, finally, he gets to go Broken Home again.
Just go, in effect, grab some of those loose ends and bring them together here, because there was a good time to do that in the Asylum. And I feel like we talked about on this quest that at some point, if they didn't want to do a full gnome finale, that might be a way to tie some of those up, too.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, for as far as certain things go, their point was made that this was really the last time they could cover stuff like the Orgra Dragonkin turning into infernal demons without it being outside the scope of what they can do with story these days. This was essentially the last gasp for wild melange of concepts, extremely elaborate world building.
Yeah, that makes sense. And in many ways, looking on that, you have a situation where you look at this is RuneScape of old, and going forward, this is RuneScape new. So because of that, maybe at this point, people decide which they like more. And granted, we didn't know what was coming at this point, but I feel like if you draw the line in the sand, this is where you draw the line in the sand, right after Twilight and Aftermath. So, I don't know. We also have to mention the Wordle Guardian aspect, the fact that restoring the edicts is a big game of Wordle.
Oh, yeah. That was a lovely way of integrating a puzzle. I will stand by that till my dying breaths.
Yeah, it was, and they chose a good environment for it. The Solak Fight Arena.
Mm-hmm. This really is the apex of your world guardianship. Like, as you, the player, you really are the main character of this. For whatever you've been for these past few years since Guthix's death.
And then after this, a lot of people, myself, and decided, no, that feels kind of empty as a result. And I think a lot of players would have felt that, in that, you know, we didn't know what was coming, and do we want to go back to, in effect, being normal, right?
Because what are you now?
Exactly. And thankfully, we have the J-Mods to make that decision for us. And I think that kind of comes into some of the criticism we'll see of Daughter of Chaos, Civil War, and Succession.
I will say, in hindsight, have we become anything else yet?
Right? That's a good question.
We're still just sort of there. A sideline to NPCs.
Another thing we need to mention in Twilight of the Gods is how there was an abrupt and direct saying that no, light and shadow are not Sliskay manifestations in your head.
Mm. Yep, there it goes. That's also a sort of last thing that fans were clinging to.
Because we went, so many people went back and forth so many times, and it was very clearly said, I forget which quest it was in, that it's not Sliskay, but at some times it felt like they were still progressing in that direction forward, so they directly have your character, or forget who, ask the question of the voices, and they say, no, we're not. We're kind of similar, but we're not.
So that comes to an end, and a lot of people genuinely miss them as a different perspective on the quests, and also one that makes your character feel like more of a character, because you have someone, you have two very annoying someones who are inextricably tied to you and your constant sounding board. So they have a voice, but they sort of give you a voice too to just express anything that might be nonsensical or interesting about the quest at any point.
Right. Yeah. And in many ways, they were like adventuring companions. So, anything else from Twilight before we move on to a fun lore nugget that happened in the middle of the year?
Yeah, I will say there is actually post-quest dialogue for this one that you would think is leading to something else, but in hindsight, I don't see how it can be, because you can talk to Hanarbus, you can talk to Naressa, you can hear about how they're working on things in the memory of Aya and on Anachronia, and that's all well and good, and it genuinely feels like it's leading to something if you read it in isolation. But if you look at it in the context of the year, I'm not sure how this can be anything but orphaned. And it's a shame, because people have built up genuine attachment to those characters, even if, like, I know Modjack has said in the Discord that Naressa is the sort of character who breaks law by existing. She is this magical sci-fi dragon from the dawn of time. And it's hard to write stories about that without her destroying everything around her by warping the law to the standards that they have set, which is that such weird elements coexist with each other in RuneScape. It feels like a shame though.
Yeah. And see that, and that's the duality of it. You can have this cosmic level RuneScape that might have been interesting to see where it would continue if they go down that path. But at the same time, you have RuneScape that's just, you know, grounded in the kingdoms. Right. So,
yeah.
And that's the path they elected to choose for this. So,
I want to say that characters can be interesting, and you can still simplify the lore behind them. And this is my plea to maybe not let it all go to waste.
That can definitely be what we can see coming out of Eye of Het, Extinction, and Twilight of the Gods. But there was a little update in June called Tales of Pride that actually had a lore element to it behind, believe it or not, and I was wondering where we were going to put this, but so thank you for bringing this up as a lore update of the year.
Yeah, I think this is really the sort of thing that RuneScape could do with doing more of, which is it's just a timeout, and you get to take a look at a whole bunch of characters. Now, naturally, the unifying theme in this is it's Pride Month. Let's do something for the LGBTQs of RuneScape. Let's take a look at some characters who we knew to be a certain way and actually sort of take a bit of a deep dive in. And it's great in that it's broad-ranging. You have characters old and new. And it's also really getting into detail in a lot of those places, some really incisively personal stuff. And outside of the context of Pride Month, I feel this is the sort of storytelling that RuneScape could really do with. Like, hypothetically, imagine if there was a mini quest entitled Tales of Leadership for this year.
Okay.
Yeah. You get a sort of insight into the various leaders of the different kingdom, like personal life of Adrastea, personal life of Moya plotting behind the scenes.
Kind of like a Netflix miniseries kind of thing.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, and in many ways, you know, exploring the diversities behind these people is wonderful, but also at the same time, it's a different take on lore and a different way of doing it, in that I don't know that many other games do it this way, in a way of putting it out straight and in the center, but at the same time, it didn't feel forced at all, did it?
Mm-hmm. Like, genuinely, there's just a lot going on in RuneScape. There's a lot of characters with a lot of different things going on in their lives, and it feels like we have a rich world going on.
Yeah, precisely. Precisely. And for what it's worth, that event will be back every June. So,
yes, with additions, they say.
Oh, with additions, they say. Interesting. All right. And if anybody missed it, June is when you'll get it next. And then with this, we head into Elite Dungeon 4 with its mini quest, which you can play on story mode, Aftermath, effectively setting the pieces in place for the Daughter of Chaos Legacy of Zamorak storyline, I think it was called.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, this is the line in the sand. There is nothing more of the old storyline beyond this point. This is a goodbye to all of the gods who have been on Yelnor up to this point. Goodbye, Saradomin. Goodbye, Armadil. And you've already kicked Zamorak off-world. So it's goodbye to Azanadra and Nex, in fact, which is a weird one.
Yeah, and yeah. People will wonder how that works with God Wars 1, but in effect, view God Wars 1 as a fragment in time kind of thing like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it is bittersweet because this is it, guys.
And they could feel their power fading away and that they would eventually be forced. And on that, they actually did decide to leave on their own. There was the question of would there be a power vacuum and such. And as a reality, in actuality, as we saw, that largely happened in the wilderness. And I feel like the people who were most upset about this were the Armadillians, probably.
Mm. Yeah, because there's three different tones to the three different scenes here. The one with Azanadra is very purely political.
Yep.
The one with Saradomin is a bit of a hybrid in that it's setting up Adrastea as the new Basilissa, but also Saradomin is her father. But you get to Armadil, and it's actually the same story that was told with Armadil in Tales of Pride, except from Armadil's perspective this time, as the surviving Avianci with his husband absolutely destroyed in the explosion of Ferenthri, and the way in which he has nothing left on this world,
yeah,
and it's just gone. And I think that kind of resonated for the Armadillians, because what do they have left, really?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And once again, you can go back to 2013 and the start of the Sixth Age to see these pieces starting to fall into place. And you wonder, when we brought all these factions in, seven or so factions on that, how are all these factions going to have a satisfying ending on that? Of course, we knew it would be Zamorak versus Saradomin in broad strokes by the end of it. But with that, you throw into questions, like you said, the Armadillian side, Nex, Azanadra. It's all very hybridized on that. And I agree. If you were a fan of the Sixth Age God storyline, you're probably scratching your head and thinking, what next? Does this feel good? And I feel like I've made my peace with it. How do you guys feel?
I don't know. I haven't been left feeling too enthused by the latest storyline.
Okay.
I feel like there's potential, but it really hasn't been realized yet.
All right, fair enough. Tanis?
I feel like, look, number one, I'm not convinced. I mean, you know how movies, story, whatever,
yeah,
is. No one's
yeah,
actually dead till you see a body.
Yep.
It just, even if you do, they may come in. So what I'm looking at is, I can see, we do need a transition period, right? Like, we need a period of cooling, like, you know, a cooling saucer right now. And I look at it the way that, look at it like how they put together, how George R.R. Martin put together A Song of Ice and Fire, right? There is this big overarching cosmic battle in the background. That's a thing, but you don't really focus on it until the very end, because you're so caught up in the palace intrigue, in the small battles in the kingdoms, and what this person's doing,
okay,
to position themselves and
okay,
that. And I could see that being the direction we actually are going.
Right, because we're kind of pivoting after Daughter of Chaos, that storyline, into something that's still wilderness-based, but this time focusing a bit on King Rolt. So that's that different perspective on it. Mm. I can see that. Okay, that's interesting.
So essentially by this, we're still on the tiny brushstrokes.
Yes, yes, yeah. And then we head to Daughter of Chaos, RuneScape's newest storyline that just ended this December, and I was absolutely blown away that we did a storyline in under 6 months.
Mm-hmm. We really did wrap it up. They definitely promised this and kept it, and that, at the very least, is a sign that they can achieve consistency with this.
Yeah, and with this, they said, look at RuneScape storylines and seasons, not necessarily ages, and that don't expect storylines, you know, to be those, you know, 3+ year-long adventures. The next one is going to be a year long with a part two in 2024, but still expect decent chunks delivered at regular intervals, which is good. So we're not going to be waiting a decade plus for Prith as an example. But drilling into Daughter of Chaos on its own, I feel like this quest did not set off the storyline on the right foot for me. I just really could never get into the Moya character. And I felt like some of the interactions combat-wise in Daughter of Chaos were rather clunky at the time. So I just really wasn't a fan of Daughter of Chaos as its own quest. I feel like the storyline did get better as it progressed. And I'll turn it over to either of you here at this point.
Yeah, I was into Moya, but I wasn't into her here.
Okay.
It felt like sort of like she wasn't the expansive character she used to be. It felt like she was limited compared to what she was in, say, the Nadir saga that sets her off and puts her on this journey of discovery and self-actualization.
Right.
And I guess it is sort of the same process of her deciding that she wants to be somewhere, wants to be someone. But it's all done in very broad strokes, just the vagueness of, I want to be someone, I want to do something, with no real attachment to what any of that someone or something is.
Yeah. And how do we feel about mechanics looking back on this?
I think I like it in hindsight.
Okay.
I remember remarking at the time that it was a sort of almost combat puzzle in that,
yep,
how do you use these abilities in a way that will clear this place without you being killed?
Yeah, yeah.
I imagine Tannis will probably have a different viewpoint.
And I feel like
a fan.
You weren't a fan.
Wasn't really a fan.
Yeah, no. And see, that's the thing. I felt like we give everybody the action bar combat system, but at the same time you're thrown in this quest and you're like, no, that's not how you do combat in this. But it did bring everybody down to the same scale on this. So.
Yeah. It also makes me wonder in hindsight why they didn't do this for the Vengeance Magister fight,
yeah,
in succession.
Both. Okay. Okay. Yeah. And we had wildly different experiences on that too. But we'll talk about that when we get to succession. And I feel like this was one final thing here on Daughter of Chaos. It was just that return to Zamorak and the demons in the wilderness kind of thing. And it was familiar yet different here. And that's how I'd sum this up.
Yeah, but
well, you know, one thing that I think can't be overlooked when you look at the, especially from like the story perspective of this, being wrapped up in 6 months like that, taking place in the wilderness with the wilderness rework and wilderness skilling and wilderness, you know, taking the PvP. This is what you would get in any other modern MMO
expansion.
Yes. And in that regard, I think it was actually good, even though we can, you know, we can argue about whether or not the
individual quest or the combat in the quest was good. The delivery of this as a packaged bit of content, mm-hmm, for the second half of the year was a success and a hit. And, you know, mm-hmm, by all accounts, the decision-making team behind this deserves a big round of applause, I think.
Yeah, it is a modular addition to the game, hey?
Yeah.
One that won't interfere with everything else.
So let's look I'm glad you said that, Tanis, because that's puts an entirely different spin on what Daughter of Chaos does. Mm-hmm. That's good. That's good. And Dimitri and Adrastea.
Yeah, it's a it's a strange buddy up. Hey,
the You've anagram got... though, we got to just mention the anagram in passing. And
Trindine,
Dimitri,
not even trying.
Yeah, Trindine. Yeah, so, but
bless her.
Yeah, but interesting pair up given where they were in the Elder God Wars and where they both came from, one being imprisoned in Caradet and the other one being a staunch Sarah-Dominist, right?
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, if you're looking for an avenue into Adrastea's character, which, as she is so pivotal lately, it's probably you probably need one, then look at how willingly she works with and Dimitri slash Trindine, because that is a weird combination that she is perfectly okay with.
I was half wondering, yeah. Sorry to interrupt, I was half wondering in the storyline if she gets stabbed in the back.
Not so far.
Yeah.
Yeah. And still completely okay with it, even with the player character just questioning it all the way. Like, really, you're still working together. Hey, okay. Have fun with that.
And then with that
doesn't, yeah.
Yeah. And then with that, we get to the Civil War mini quests that were used to fill out the Infernal Puzzle Box, bringing content like Garden of Charid, the Wilderness rework, and the Wilderness Flash events. But with this, they were literally 5-minute long mini quests with a cutscene at the beginning and the end of it, and this was the bite-sized lore in this series with Daughter of Chaos at the beginning and Succession at the end.
Yeah, I kind of felt underwhelmed by this.
Yeah, I agree. They happened. There's really not much to report on this. They did make a fun note about Maud Blackwitch's drawings in the sofa.
canonized a few people I know in the art community.
That's true. That's right. That as well. But beyond that, I feel like it was just rather slow progression and kind of tick some boxes as we went. I don't know that there's much else to say on these. Yep. Is there?
We did content. Good job.
Yeah. Okay. Succession, and this is where things are going to get interesting because you and I and Tanis have actually not discussed this quest together here. Mm-hmm. I know we did talk about the Doomsday device in that quest, and if there's going to be one thing that that quest would be known for, it would be the puzzles that let you squish people in the Doomsday device.
I did enjoy squishing people.
I did too. Nobody else did on the show when I was on.
We knew you would say. We knew.
Sometimes you just got to squish a couple hapless guards.
And it's also worth noting that Succession was the last project that Maud Raven worked on before he departed.
Yes.
So special call out to that.
Yeah. As much as I got to say the quest left me cold on release, it did feel like a fitting tribute to Maud Raven because the character of Vengeance is one of the very first he brought into the game.
Right.
And he gets to bring her full circle.
Right. And that was who we played as when we were fighting the Magister.
Mm-hmm.
Which was an interesting fight combat-wise because...
Was it?
Well, it was because it was such a opposed experience between myself and people who were familiar with the combat system versus people who were not familiar with it.
How so?
In that the fight with the Magister became a lot easier if you were comfortable with defenses and if you worked those in. Whereas, on the other hand, if you weren't, you would have had a harder time.
Okay, so it is.
So my,
it is kind of limited action bar, but in this case, regular old action bar, just you are forced to have a shield.
Yes, and the interesting part about that and how I nuked the Magister in that fight was after running a defensive rotation and just building up adrenaline, I just hit Onslaught and absolutely nuked the thing, which is an ability that comes from raids and a very small portion of the player base has. So that really showed how if you have these tools, the quest boss fight playing as Vengeance is easy, but if you don't, it's a little bit more difficult. And that was one of the discussions that we had on that.
For what it's worth, they do let you skip this one entirely if you fail it enough times.
If you fail it twice. Yeah. And that was another good thing about this quest that we jumped up and down about, was that if you failed the puzzles too many times, you failed the combat too many times, you got to skip past it and still experience the lore. And
that I think that's accessibility.
And I think that's how questing should be done. The quest got full marks on accessibility in that range. So in many ways, I rated this quest 5 out of 5 when we talked about it, and I got many raised eyebrows because of that.
Fair enough. From that perspective, fair enough.
So that's what I wanted to say looking back on Succession. What do you want to say since you haven't had the podcast as a platform to do that yet?
Yeah, so I want to talk about that fight, but in a meta sense, because the way I experienced this quest was on stream with a few people who hadn't done the quest and one who had. And that one who had just sort of went silent in the entire build up to this fight and then just sort of announced, yeah, this is BS. Because we had this entire fight, which was just regular, unadulterated combat, no special abilities from the Magister. And what you have here is a massive, massive Slayer boss who I can't even fight yet in game. I don't have that Slayer level yet. And meanwhile, you have a Forgotten Warrior from Demonheim who you've probably killed a million of on your way down Demonheim. And somehow she absolutely flattens him. Well, presuming you win the fight anyway. But yeah, canonically, she wins that. And people were skeptical of that because with the levels of power involved, the Magister is very much one of those wild world-building characters with a million and one reasons to take over the world and destroy it in an instant. Meanwhile, Vengeance is very much just a lady who got really angry when her brother died. And in a meta sense, this is really a conflict between the grounded world building, which Vengeance is very much a hallmark of, versus the cosmic scale, and the grounded defeats the cosmic, hey?
Oh my god, thank you for saying that. That's a piece of analysis that we didn't touch when we talked about Succession, so I'm glad you brought that here.
Hey, you're welcome.
I look at the quest differently now that you say that, so...
I think the fight worked better in a meta sense than in an in-game sense in that way.
So perhaps when we were there, we focused a little bit too much on the combat side then. Fair enough. Okay. Anything else from Succession, either of you? Oh, we got to talk about the song at the end.
Yes.
The song and the cutscene. Because the juxtaposition of that was just, I felt weird at the time, but it makes sense looking at it, kind of how we got this peaceful world on the surface, but the Zamorakians are just, you know, full of chaos as they like to be.
Yeah, this is the part where the dual meaning of the title really comes into play. You've got the succession from Sarad-Omen to Adrastea on top, and you've got the succession from Bilrak to Moya down below. And these are happening simultaneously. And, well, I don't think it really worked that well, to be honest. I wish Bilrak hadn't been killed off screen. I wish there had been some kind of climactic boss fight there, like some sort of pinnacle to
that. And that was our thing as well, is that you could have split this into 2 or 3 quests. Or because 2 quests and a mini quest, right? So
It felt like Moya was off screen since Daughter of Chaos had a brief resurgence in Civil War 3, but that was so tiny it was just a blip on the radar. And now she's back, and now she just destroys, and she's the leader now.
And we'll have to see where that lands for 4 and 3. But once again, just like I said at the beginning, I wasn't able to get into using Moya as the character here. So maybe that's what set me off on the wrong foot for this storyline. So,
In the aftermath of this quest, I found it very hard to shrug the feeling that we just spent 6 months shuffling chess pieces around.
For what, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. Okay, and I can see that. And I feel like that came from the lower ratings off-air from Earth and on-air from you, Tanis, and Thaxi when we did that episode. So, okay, that makes sense. And I think you guys are all valid in your opinions on that.
Hmm.
All right. Anything else for the lore of 2022, the story of RuneScape in 2022?
It was big. You can't deny that. Like, we have had some serious dry years of content for lore. And in spite of what people might feel about this, we cannot deny that this is the result of serious thought about what people want RuneScape's story to be and where they want it to go. So at the very least, it is strongly prioritized.
Yeah. And for the record, this was 4 quests and let's see,
6 mini quests.
7 mini quests if you count Tales of Pride.
Fair enough.
Which is a huge year for quests and lore. So, Tanis, anything else on that you want to add to this before we move on to our baby?
No, I think it was, I think if you were a quest and lore person, you were well served this year. And I think, you know, another analogy or example you could use is we're moving away from the big blockbuster movies like, this is the Disney Plusation of RuneScape, where we're going away from the big Star Wars movies to the TV series. And
so here we go. We've got Andor. You've got your Mandalorian.
That's right. So 2023, we're gonna Andor the shit out of RuneScape, and we're going to love it. Good things to come.
All right. Thanks, Questcaping, for joining us. See you next
year. Thank you very much.
And before we move on to our skilling section, I just want to take a moment and thank some Patreon supporters, because without you guys, what we do here at RSBNB Update to its full extent would not be possible. So in particular, this week, I would like to thank Amos Reed, Andrew C., Arvid Zell, Beekeeper Steve, Bryflex, Big Huge Rat, Chunk the Monk, Cycle RS, Diana, Drama Free, Duramax, Elomady, Enrique V, Flaws of Man, Free Milk, Jacob G, Jade Gizmo, Jason S, Jeebus, Jesse W, Keski, Ling01, Mohan V, Nate the Great, Nick G, OTR Gamer, Pernasius, Ricky A, Samuel FL, Skiotan, Scott DS, Shirtpants, Stub Eve, The Naked Captain, The Dabbin' Goat, Tim, Tom V, and Zant. Thank you everybody for your support. It truly means the world to us. And if you're wondering what all this is about, you can head on over to patreon.com/RSBNB. We're starting for as little as $1 a month. You gain access to an entire back catalog of monthly bits, or bonus shows as we like to call them. They cover all sorts of topics, everything ranging from skill tier lists this year. Those have been some of the most popular, to what you can actually do with Legacy Combat, which is quite surprising when you think about it, all the way to our most recent one, Holiday Events in RuneScape. And with that, you also get a mention in the show notes each and every week. For $3 a month, you can join what we call the RSBNB Update VIP tier. You'll receive a special rank on Discord, chat channel access, a mention on the podcast at the start of the month, and access to high-quality stereo versions of the podcast. For $5 a month, you'll receive a shout-out on the podcast each and every week. We call this our insider tier, and you also gain exclusive access to the outtakes that we use to make the clip show at the end of the year, in addition to everything else. And once again, as we are wrapping up the year, a big huge thank you to our Patreon supporters, past and present, who have allowed us to do what we do here at RSBNB Update. It means the world to us. Thanks so much. And with that, we move on to the skilling updates of the year. And Tanis, I know you and I were sitting here and we were thinking, what's the breakdown going to be on this? And I think as listeners will know, you know, being 45, 50 minutes in at this point with us heading on to skilling now, skilling is going to be where we go next and have the second biggest focus of this year, I think.
Yeah, and not not bad, right? Like, we got a pretty decent mix. But I would definitely agree that this is probably the second biggest chunk of updates out of the year.
Yeah, and that makes you and people like Parnassius, who's also here, happy about this, because this is your guys' bread and butter.
Oh, yeah,
definitely.
Yeah, this is what I like to do.
And that's it. And I mean, I was sort of thinking earlier, just we've had a lot of the combat type stuff, but I mean, a lot of this stuff did come earlier in the year, so you sort of, you do tend to sort of forget things that's happened sort of 5, 6, 7, 8 months ago. But yeah, looking over this, we did get a fairly decent sort of skilling update for us this year as well.
So. Yeah, yeah, and this all started in January with Het's Oasis, which was the removal of the Duel Arena or Sand Casino, as people in Tannis's circle calls it.
I still think I could have been a gold sink, man. We missed the boat on that
one. I don't think we want to legitimize gambling in RS. I'm much happier with Het's Oasis. And I put this at the back end of it, but the reason Het's Oasis stood out so much was this got so many of us in Fresh Start to 99 and beyond farming without seeds, because it provided for AFK farming method with the flowers available at levels 30, 50, 70, and 90 in terms of the roses, the irises, the hydrangeas, and the hollyhocks. And, I mean, we did not have a real method of AFK farming before aside from the seed-aside, which a fully kitted-out seed-aside setup at high enough farming levels with the right abilities can still eclipse Het's Oasis, but we needed something we could get into on day one. Go ahead.
Yeah, but that seed aside option, that way, you still also need a very high slayer, or, you know, very reasonable slayer level too. You know, 65, I think, would be the minimum, preferably up around the sort of 80 for the slayer to be doing that. And it also depended on the seeds that were dropping, because if you don't have the farming level, the seeds get destroyed, but you don't get the XP for them.
Yeah.
So that was another thing that you sort of had to take into account. So, yeah, Het's Oasis for AFK farming was brilliant. It was also awesome for Hunter.
Yeah. And, you know, I feel like we've got a unique perspective on that, because we learned that on Fresh Start, because I made my skill pier last year, and levels 1 to 30 Hunter were absolutely brutal and painful. But with the hunting of the scarabs at Het's Oasis, poof, easy.
It's like so many things we learned from from Fresh Start. I don't think I truly could appreciate this content when it came out.
No.
Until taking a new account through it like this.
110% agree with you there. As people know, I was 10 days late starting Fresh Start. I wasn't getting into it until I heard Shane and Thaxi talking about it all the time, but I decided, okay, I'm going to jump in and have a look. I'll just buy, you know, a week's membership and see how I go. And I stayed there basically until the competition side of it ended, when everyone started, you know, just buying keys, and all it was doing was it just become, you know, portables scape. But these Het's Oasis and all those mid-level ones are really great updates for beginning, you know, new and beginning players, and even mid-level players. Very, very good update. Playing Fresh Starts rose this update in my mind.
Yeah, it did. It did. And, I mean, we're talking about low to mid-level right now, right? But Het's also brought in the prayer powders in that, I mean, in most places, they effectively killed off gilded altars.
How good are they, though?
Well, I mean, you can use the powder at burials, and you don't need a gilded altar now. You can use the powder of penance to reduce the amount of prayer drain that you take. And this was my gold mine in Fresh Start for making money, because people were buying the golden roses to make those powders of penance from Het's.
Yeah, but the other good thing about the powder of burial, it works with your bone crusher. So if you're going slaying, you don't need to collect all your dragon bones anymore. You know, pop one of those burial powders, and your bone crusher and that, and just watch your prayer levels go up as you're doing Slayer and things like that. It was really a brilliant all-round update. It sort of affected a lot of different areas. It wasn't just farming. It wasn't just Hunter.
It was also agility.
It had an outreaching effect on other things. And, yeah, that agility course was brilliant.
Tannis, were you going to say something about the powders before we move on to the agility?
No, I forget what I was going to say. But right. it was an ecosystem.
That's the word.
We love ecosystems.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. And I mean, before the agility side of Het's Oasis, you would go from level 52 until the mid 60s, and I think 75 in some cases, at the wilderness course till you get to the Apatol monkey course. But now you do wilderness to 65, and then the Het's agility course from 65 to 80-ish for advanced gnome. That's how you do agility if you want to run laps at this point. So once again, completely changed what you do at the mid-level. And, you know, I think one thing we learned from this is that a lot of people out there did not give this content a fair shake when it launched. And that's true from the community, that's true from the content creator side. And you really need to have that perspective of what it's like leveling through. You can just go through it and say, hey, this is X amount of XP per hour, or you can actually experience it.
So, yeah, and I think that's what Fresh Starts gave everyone, that ability to experience that. And hopefully, JAGEX will do more to try and bring in new players, because that early and mid-game level now is... I mean, it's a hell of a lot more fun and engaging than it was, when I started 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I treasure hunted the first 27 levels on my skill pier for Hunter. So that changes that.
Well, I mean, my first, 40 levels of Hunter, I did not with nothing but Chronicle Fragments.
Het's Oasis, definitely... one of the strong points of the year, also from the graphical standpoint. But we went after that through a combat and questing binge, and then we came out the other end, and we have the accidental skilling update on the Ranch Out of Time Peninsula, where we have the activities of segregation, zygomite hairstyling, experimentation, and the fletching of the dine arrows. And we're going to start with segregation. This is a fire-making method, level 87, fire making, and you can use the sharp shell shards, I said it right, with that to get either fire making XP or dine arrows. And where this came in is that this was, I'd say, a medium intensity skilling activity that gave 312,000 XP per hour if you were harvesting for the tips, and 390,000 XP per hour if you were harvesting and burning, or 415,000 XP per hour. These are unboosted numbers. If just bought or burnt. So once again, another skilling update, except this time on the very high level end, specifically for fire making, for people who don't want to line fire make or burn logs.
Yeah, this was a really nice addition, just with another method, right? Like I'm not big on line fire making, bonfires and stuff is fine, but I like this as a way to do fire making, and I guess if you do the fire making, you don't get the arrows, but still, it's a different, it's another method.
Yeah, and it also provided a method of getting dinosaur eggs for Iron Man characters who didn't want to do big game Hunter or Slayer for that. So, yeah. I was hoping there would be more people rushing quests and doing this on Fresh Start, but I don't think that was the case, because the dinosaur market is still very dry, even as of a couple weeks ago. So,
yeah.
Keep in mind, you needed Extinction for this update to play this update in Tannis. I remember
it's a hell of a line.
I remember we did the special with Mod Jack and Mod Shrike for Extinction, and you got up to the boss fight for that episode, but then you realized, oh, Zygomite accidental skilling update's coming. Oh, we got to get you through this boss fight to access to the skilling method.
Which was rough.
Yeah, yeah,
we did it though.
But we didn't. Zygomite hairstyling, fire making or fletching. And with this, this is where you got the shafts, the tempered fungal shafts for either fire making or fletching XP. And with this, this is how you got your headless dine arrows. And we saw numbers on this of about 290,000 XP per hour if just focusing on the fire making, or 230,000 XP per hour if just focusing on the fletching. And when you combine this all, it was about 115 fletching and 150k fire making XP per hour, which once again, we're talking high level, but still very good numbers on this. And I'm sure some people in the high end skill community did go there, as I remember seeing lots of people around there when this update dropped.
Yeah, oh, yeah. My alt account was up to this, and I mean two of the skills I don't like are fletching and fire making. This was a brilliant update, and I just love the choice. They gave us more choice, but not the same as the old way, just with a different XP drop. This was something totally different and gave us something to do. You can get a little reward out of it. Chasing those dino eggs was a great way to do it. If you didn't want to do big game hunter and such, I thought, yeah, again, another that they hit the nail on the head again with this one.
Lots of good puns and graphical environment work on this too. So
yeah, and the Zygomites are all little cute creatures,
so. The mushroom people.
Yeah,
and decent. I mean. You know, decent money too. So I mean, it was once again, it was I mean, it was another little ecosystem that they built with the skilling update.
Yeah, I think at the end of this, I fletched like 40,000 dine arrows.
Mm.
And I mean, I only used a handful of them on ED4, but still. Nonetheless, the next activity here was experimentation, the highest leveled activity, which was 95 fire making. And the tagline behind this one was, feed them with their favorite food until they're full. And then after this, they'll leave you with Potterington Blend number 102 fertilizer. Which then you resulted in burning that to make dinosaur propellant for the arrows, or you could use it to make ultra compost.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where Tanis, we had to really tap into the cracked skilling community at the end, your friends and you and whatnot.
Yeah.
If you were playing full sweaty on this, trying to be as efficient as possible, just north of 1 million XP per hour in fire making.
Yeah, it's pretty insane.
And then
all the movement abilities, yeah, and all of that stuff. But then
as simpletons tested it, and with the odd surge in escape, it went down to about 600 or 700k. And if you just walk between all the points, it was still 420,000 XP per hour unboosted.
Just still, and that damn good, right, for fire making.
Exactly, and that's what I was gonna say. Again, brilliant. This gives those people. It gives you all three training methods. You sweaty, lean forward. I mean, a mil seems a bit high, but if you're playing hard at it, I mean, you're not. It's fine to get that. I don't know of many people who would be doing that. There may be 2 or 3% of the community who do that. That averaged 600 or 700k. And then if you want to just AFK, just click on it every sort of 10-15 seconds. So semi AFK, I shouldn't say AFK, with the no surge and such. 420k is still great. You could just kick back. And the way I was doing it, a lot of these is, I'm in my lounge on the laptop and just watching Netflix just on the laptop, so I just have to click it now and then. And again, it really it ticked all the boxes.
Yep. And this is all still there too, right? Like every double XP that comes through, that's 950. You know what I mean? Like you could get all the way up to damn near 2 mil. Like you can make what you want out of it. So
in fact, if you've got your own bonus XP as well, you can do 3 mil an hour.
Yeah.
Brawling gloves.
Yeah,
3.5 mil an hour. Can we keep going?
Fresh start modifiers, if you had extinction done on there, which would have been insane. But
if you could have gotten to a 95 fire making.
Ooh, boy.
That'd have been rough.
Yeah. And then, of course, the fletching of the dine arrows, which we knew were for an impending ranged update, tier 95 arrows. And we'll talk more about the combat side of these in the combat segment. We got raked over the coals for not talking about them until the tastemakers had said which we should and shouldn't use, but I digress. Tempered shafts plus dinosaur propellant gave you the headless arrows, the dine arrows rather, for 45k XP an hour. Then, adding the sharp shell shards to the headless arrows, giving you basic dine arrows, 600,000 fletching XP per hour this was.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then the slow part was charging the arrows with the anima from the Elder God Wars fronts, which was about 244,000 XP per hour. And this was subsequently changed, I think, in November to fit it in the game logout timer window, because if you started a batch of these arrows and you just, you know, let it run, it would log you out because it took so long, so they adjusted that.
Mm-hmm.
And kept the XP consistent, of course. So, overall, I feel like we're 2 for 2 on skilling updates here.
Definitely. Oh,
yeah, easily.
Yeah. This was, again, this one, especially for someone like me who doesn't like the fletching and fire making, knocked it out of the park. And, and you made money from it too, which was another good thing. You got good XP, but you also got decent money. And I don't know what the prices are these days, but, sort of that first couple of months, we were making good GP out of those.
They're still busting clouds, right?
Oh, yeah, they are. They are for people who use ranged, which is becoming a minority or has been a minority, but more on that in the combat segment. Then we come to August in the Wilderness rework, which...
Update of the century.
Okay. Tanis, I know you have different opinions on that.
Well, it's better now, but I still found it, just as easy to die.
Right, it got better when we got the stuff from the flash events, which we'll talk about next, to prevent threat from causing a shellacking to you, which I got you killed once because I asked you to go test something in the before pre-show. What did you get nuked by? Hydric dragons or something?
No, it was the Abyssal creatures. Something like that.
Especially if you don't have the Slayer level to fight back on them.
Yeah, I mean, I had the level. It's just that I was just mobbed. There was just too many of them. There was nothing.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. So that was Wilderness Slayer. They basically took the creatures that were in the wilderness and amped them up to a point where Wilderness Slayer became a way that people could train it with the new Mandrith Slayer tasks, which were tasks that could be completed in the wilderness, and with this, you would be awarded 15 Slayer points per task completed, plus the threat level that you were at. So if you made it to threat level 10, you get an additional 10 Slayer points. You also got one Reaper point if you didn't die, kill anything out the wilderness, or skip any tasks. So you had to accomplish all three of those to get a Reaper point for that. And you also got a Wilderness Slayer chest, which had a myriad of rewards in it, including things like Brawling Gloves, new Necronium Salvage, as well as things like the Trail Begone and the Volcanic Protection item, but also the Wilderness Weapons that you used to only be able to get from the Bounty Hunter shop.
Yeah. Which, those weapons, I wish I had one right now for what I'm doing in Fresh Start. I could kill for one.
Yeah, and I mean, would you do Slayer in the Wilderness right now with what we have, in particular from the, just, sheer availability of the things that prevent threat from going up now?
Yeah, if I could afford the stones right now over here with what I'm playing, then I would probably give it a shot, yeah.
Okay. See,
it's definite from me. I love the new Wilderness with not just having players coming up and just jumping on you from things. And
I thought I was going to say that when we got this, that this would make me like Slayer with it being in the wilderness, but it didn't accomplish that for me. So the thing I want to take away from the Wilderness rework is, of course, we got the graphical update on it. But like you say, we also got the fact that you don't need to worry about PvP anymore, in that we can go do our herb runs without worrying. We can go do Hunter in the Wilderness without worrying. We can go do Agility in the Wilderness without working. If you go, of course, do Divination, you will still get PvP toggled on, so just keep that in mind. You could still use a Demonic Skull to get more XP, But another change that came with the Wilderness rework, and this was something that was a back and forth with the community that they decided to do, was that Abyssal Runecrafting, as of a week after the Wilderness update launched, no longer required PvP enabled, which meant that you can now use the Abyss as a money-making method or runecrafting training method without worrying about PKers.
Yeah, and I've actually, for the first time ever, started doing runecrafting through the Abyss after August 8. I actually do my runecrafting through there now. I've never, ever done it in the previous 10 years of playing through the Abyss. I've always just done it normally. But now I can go there and do it. So.
Well, yeah. I mean, things like water runes and fire runes and blood runes and whatnot are stupid money if you do it right. So.
Yep.
I mean, why not at that point? I already mentioned the agility and the demonic skull, but once again, it is a place that you can actually go now if you're level 52 agility, moving between some of the earlier courses and the new Hetz Oasis agility course. And I think
the funny thing.
Go ahead.
So just the funny thing with the agility course is if you do get those mobs coming at you because you've been there too long and you know they're unhappy with you, just go to the next section and they stay there. They don't follow you through. So you wait for 30 seconds, they disappear, continue on your way.
Yeah, yeah. And this leads to, I think, the final point on this is that combating threat was difficult, but now it's a lot simpler following the flash events, specifically the items in the obsidian palmstone, which prevents the threat from increasing, or trail begone, which will actually lower your threat by one if you're concerned about that sort of thing. And, you know, you guys think that this update was successful in taking the stigma out of the wilderness?
I do. I mean, I as I said, I avoided the wilderness like the plague before the update. Mm-hmm. I do say tongue in cheek when I say update of the century. By the way,
sure.
Yeah, it just means
because that's
going to
be necromancy, right?
Oh God, no! That actually might make me quit if it's not as good as archaeology. It's got to have all the aspects of archaeology in it for me to enjoy necromancy. But no, I mean, to be being able to go out there, I mean, the wilderness events are fine. I don't use any of those palm stones or trail be gone. The only thing I do use is the little pyramid I got that I can go to any of the, of those levels.
Yeah.
The obelisks, that's the one.
I mean, it'd be interesting if you could actually use that without outside of the teleport area, but...
It would have been good. Yeah. You still got to go down to level 30 before you can use it. It would be good if it was able to be used anywhere, but yeah.
I want to talk about the flash events now because this was the moneymaker for Fresh Start because we were all wondering what the source of alchables was going to be for Fresh Start and how are we going to get the first GP, right? Well, these flash events drop Necronium Salvage. We were having trouble finding Rune Salvage, but lo and behold, now we got Necronium. And there's a good chance you'll get some of these from the flash events. And there's 13 flash events that run on a cycle. They repeat twice a day. So if it's at an odd time in which you're not going to be able to get the one that you want, just wait a couple days and it will be... at a more convenient time. And, you know, these became a big, big part of my Fresh Start gameplay because whenever the farming one was up or whenever the Bloodwood tree was up, I would always go there because by the time we were in the, you know, the high level 100s farming, these things, you know, were 70 to 80,000 XP an hour or XP per drop, right? Two times a day. Mm. So you're not going to give up on 160K farming XP. You're going to try and hit these events whenever they come up. So... They worked their way into my gameplay here. Tanis, I know you were lukewarm on these when they came out. How do you feel about them now?
I mean, I think they're nice. I might give a little bit more of a try, but you know, sometimes it's just hard to drag yourself out of established patterns.
Even for potentially 160,000 XP an hour in the high level 100s. Doing something like that twice a day.
3 minutes.
Yeah, probably. Because it's not like something you can just... I don't know. For me, trying to find the stuff, there's just... There's more to it than just going.
And that's where I want to go next in terms of finding them. You can of course have the imp in Edgevale teleport you to the active one, but in order to do that, you need to have completed all the flash events first, which is a comp requirement. Yeah.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
I was going to say, it would have been nice if the obelisk, if you got that obelisk, it could teleport you to
The imp is just directly north of the Edgevale lodestone.
Wow, okay, I've learned something.
Yeah. And, it's a comp requirement here, and there's also a trim requirement on them to play each one a certain number of times that's still going out there, which, I mean, the problem with this came in is that this was when Civil War Part 2, the mini quest, came out, and they locked that behind four different flash events. Now, that's potentially four shots that you're hitting on this, or you can target the KBD Rampage or the Evil Bloodwood Tree, because those are the special events that each count for three, and then do one on top of that. But I don't think that was made clear, that those count for three for that quest requirement on that. So in many ways, I mean, I understand having it as comp, but I think it was a little bit rough to assign that as one of the requirements to complete Civil War II. And once again, that's not a criticism of the Flash event itself. It's talking about content that was released in tandem with it. So
my biggest issue with the events is more the combat ones, where when you've got a lot of people, you just can't see, because there's so many people around, you can't see what you're supposed to be hitting.
Yeah.
Or what happens to me, I've been to Forgotten Soldiers five times. I've completed it once, because as soon as it starts, I get the wilderness creatures aren't happy with your stay here, even though I've walked in there literally 30 seconds ago, and I'm getting attacked, so I've got to kill off an abyssal creature, and then by the time I get back to hitting the Forgotten Soldiers, they're all dead, and I haven't made my 70k. That's happened three out of four times that I've attempted those ones.
Yeah, so what we're hearing is that it's the random nature of the wilderness that makes these flash events kind of difficult.
Yeah,
you
said, you're there 30 seconds and you get two abyssal creatures on you, I mean, it doesn't matter if it's a dark beast or something that attacks you, you kill those in two or three hits. But when you're wasting, 30 seconds to kill two abyssal creatures, and, there's people there, and, they've just taken down all the Forgotten Soldiers, and you don't have a chance, you've only done 40 or 50k damage, I think they need to do something about that side of things. And if you do the, I think it's called the Shooting Star one, where you mine the star and then the Pyre Fiends come out, trying to kill those Pyre Fiends when there's more than sort of 10 or 12 people there, because of all the explosions, and it's just so hard to see them to know what you're clicking on.
Yeah, so what I'm getting from this is the flash events were good in concept, but in execution there's a couple of rough spots around the edges. And we would be remiss if we didn't talk about the enchantments that came from these. The dark facet of grace for the Grace of the Elves that completely removes the prayer drain rate when using the skilling prayers, and it now holds up to 2,000 porter charges. And Tanis, I got you excited about this, but then I told you that these things are going for max cash.
Yeah, and then I'm like, never mind. Don't need it that bad. I mean, sounds cool, but not. Yeah.
They're why I still go and do the flash events every opportunity I get, because I'm trying to get those.
Yeah, and then the one for the Dark Facet of Passage gives it infinite charges, and the Dark Facet of Luck gives a 1% chance to skip a clue step, and a 0.1% chance to get two reward caskets on clue completion. Also adds a teleport to the Dwarven Outpost, but once again, hilariously expensive for these, and stupidly rare as well. And this is kind of in terms of the same PVM discussion about whether or not things are too rare in drops, and I feel like the answer to this is yes, because these things aren't supposed to be, as rare as party hats, right? They're supposed to be something that you should be able to get after a certain number of failed attempts. I wouldn't feel bad if they added you know, a pity chance to it, so that if you didn't get one after 50 and then 100 and then 200, it would ramp up the chance of you getting them.
Like they do with the pet drops, just give you that sort of little bit extra.
Yeah.
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 Yeah, I think they should be like, yeah, a 1 in 250 chance, I don't mind. 1 in 500, I think, might be a bit outside. But, you know, 1 in 100 or 1 in 250 is not too bad. And then sort of add a multiplier once you've hit that amount to try, you know, to have a double roll at it or something.
Yeah. So to sum up the flash events, good for XP, good for salvage, hit or miss on execution in terms of just visual clutter for some of the events and finding them, and also the items are too rare still on that.
Probably 3 out of 5 for me, but yeah, okay. it was still decent. But and as I said, I still do them a couple of times a day when I can, especially the Bloodwood Tree. I try and always do that one and the Shooting Star.
Yeah. All right. This brings us to Master Max, an update that slipped its way in October, and when in reality is one of the simplest RS updates of the year, and that it's a new cape that's added that just has a requirement of virtual 120 on all skills. And when you think about it, they just had to make the artwork for Master Max, Master Comp, and trimmed Master Comp or Master Max, or whatever the hell kind of name it would be, on that. And I know multiple people who have said that, yeah, now it's time to go for 120 all because of this. Parnassus, you already had 120s coming in?
I had all 120, so I was able to do it on the spot. And what I loved, we had like a little micro quest that we had to do to unlock it. I really appreciated doing that. The cape itself, it's great to have. It's, in my opinion, it's a pretty ugly cape, but, you know, so be it. I don't care about that because, you know, I have my override of my Master Quest cape anyway that sort of overrides every cape. The one thing I was disappointed about was, though, it still only had, you know, sort of 3 abilities you could lock onto it. Yeah, having 120 in all, I think just wearing that cape, it should just have the perks of every cape on it automatically.
Yeah,
maybe not the combat ones, but certainly all the skilling ones.
Yeah,
because you really only do one skill at a time anyway, and it just, you know, to be able to put all my other capes on my cape rack and just keep this one as my skill cape, would have been ideal, but, you know, it is what it is.
Hear, hear.
I think they have the Master Cape Max cape over in OSRS as well, and it has all the perks on it. So I think they did fail a little bit on that. So again, a 3 out of 5 3.5 out of 5 on this one for me, because yeah, that little micro quest beforehand and such, and it does. It's, you know, for people who are goal oriented. It gives you a reason to go for 120, which is not overkill for anyone. It's a cosmetic cape. You can do 3 different perks on it, as opposed to your standard max cape or comp cape. So you can just put 3 skilling ones on there, and it's not going to affect your master max. Your comp cape or your standard max cape. It does sort of then give you an opportunity to have sort of, you know, 2 capes with 3 different ones on it. But yeah.
All right, fair enough. And my concern with it was that, you know, this is a discussion folks will have heard about in our Mod Jack episode. Go back and listen to that one, that's not even out yet. I'm recording Year in Review. That I got myself confused. The Mod Jack episode is already recorded. The Mod Jack episode will be out first of the year. Well, first episode of the year, not on the first. Ay, that's a confusion. Anyways, the discussion with him kind of led us into a discovery that, you know, RuneScape builds its achievements in such a way that a lot of them are actually driven by where the players are and what the players are going to do. In that, he said if you go back a few years, 120 all, a cape for 120 all would not have been a good idea. Just like right now, a 200 mil cape, all 200 mil all cape would not be a good idea. So I can see it from that logic. I don't think I will personally go for it. Tanis, where do you come in?
I just think it was something that people have been asking for a long time. It didn't take much to give the people what they wanted in this way. And Yeah, I'm a fan of it. It's definitely something I'll, you know, pursue. That's something that I like to kind of, you know, I like to skill. Max was always my my goal,
right?
For everything, you know, that was my overarching goal. So it's definitely something I'll pursue. And yeah, I'm a fan just because, like, I don't know if it was right or wrong for the game, you know, whenever they did it, but I know it's, we've been wanting it for a long time. So.
All right, fair enough. And then we head on to the second to last update of the year, Garden of Charid, a farming update that saw herb drops removed from bosses and reduced from slayer creatures. And alongside this, it increased the number of herbs that you can plant through various upgrades, which at 10 seeds maximum now results in a 3x yield increase from what we had previously. And with this, they also got rid of the crop dying mechanic. So now that they just get diseased and stop growing, so you're not going to be, you know, out hundreds of thousands of GP on your fresh start world if your magic tree dies. So that's a nice quality of life fix alongside this. And this is, of course, where we got the infamous clip, the Plower Panthers on the clip show because of a typo that I did, but that's the plant power upgrade that increases the number of herbs that you can plant. I'm just going to continue running down the other list of the other notable things we got from here, and then we can gush over the amount of herbs that we pulled out from this. There's an upgrade that reduces the amount of time that it took for herbs to cycle down to 60 minutes from 80 minutes. Upgrades to increase the speed at which we make incense not disappear when you die. And one of the bigger things that came from this was the Sticky Fingers relic being replaced and making it so that all pickpocketing in game is persistent. Not 100% like Prif pickpocketing, but you will just continue pickpocketing the target, which greatly reduces the amount of clicking that's needed on there. And with this, they actually brought forward a number of new thieving targets, but most interestingly, the Cruxical Knights, when launched, had 1.3 million XP per hour. That was since toned down to about 800,000 XP per hour. Still, you know, a very good thieving method that requires a good amount of input in terms of things like the Master Camo outfit, the Traherne exoskeleton aura, so on and so forth. So
yeah, I was going to say, when you're talking that, you do have to have everything.
Yeah, the full
spells
setup.
You have to run an aura for it. So, you know, unless you do sort of aura resets and things, I mean, the farming side of it, I thoroughly enjoyed. I thought that was good. You know, planting 10 seeds, I mean, if you're going to be using your growth potions, just do one seed at a time, because your yield per herb is going to be more, because as you go up, yes, you're getting more herbs, but you know, it's dropping down the amount of herbs you get out. So when you're planting 10, you're averaging sort of 4 or 5 herbs per patch, whereas when you do one, I think you were getting 7 or 8 per patch.
Well, no, it's the same numbers, just expanded out to a factor of times 3 on the end. And what we're seeing with that is, because you're planting more seeds, you're winding up with a more consistent spread. And that's why it looks like your numbers are going down on that.
Okay.
So that's
fair enough.
That's what happens behind it. Yeah.
Okay. That was just what I was looking at. I'm going, hang on, I'm getting more per single seed than I am the 10
times
seed.
Right. It looks like
that,
but as you plant more seeds, the randomness just becomes more consistent, and you want to plant more seeds because that's how you get more favor points.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Your favor points are the other things. Once you've got that maxed out, I mean, you always do 10 while you're trying to get those favor points to max that out. The thieving side of it, I wasn't overly impressed. It was just the same old, you know, click, let it go. But all the stuff that you had to have with spells and auras and all that type of stuff, I don't think sort of anything should rely on an aura to be successful. I think aura should help, should be a boost, but shouldn't be sort of something that is a necessity to make it a good thing. Because if you didn't have the aura and all that, I mean, you were always getting more experienced hands. Yeah, Well, I was getting more XP pickpocketing ham members than I was pickpocketing these Crux guys.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the thing, and that's why there's so much, you know, going on about this. Oh, they nerfed it from 1.3. No, you need the full setup for that, and that if you're not doing that and you want something that's a little bit less intensive, that's what safes are for.
Yep.
So, overall, once again, I feel like they hit it out of the park with this Garden of Kharid update. We have to hope that this is going to provide the herbs that are needed, because we all know the serial offenders of things like Telos and Hellweir and whatnot that were providing tons of herbs into the economy. At this point, Mod Jack has been open. He said, you know, this is an experiment to see if the skilling community can provide the supplies.
Yeah, and this has always been one of my biggest pet peeves about the combat side is, you know, I could go and do Chaos Giants and get more herbs per hour than I could ever do farming. I love this. I would love to see more sort of herbs being taken off drop tables. You know, add the seeds, take the herbs off, and let the farmers go. Hopefully it is successful and we can do that. Especially going forward, as we, when death cost reworks start happening, that, you know, perhaps we can see sort of less necessity for, you know, all the skilling drops to be coming for them to make money. Because if it's not going to be costing them as much money if they die, well, you know, they shouldn't be making as much money off things that should be coming in through skilling.
Oh, we had a fun conversation about that with death costs on that episode.
I'm halfway through that episode at the moment, so again, you know, you've got to give and take, and I mean, you've got to be there for the entire community. You can't just concentrate on the combat side and say, oh, they've got to make money because of the risk. Well, what risk now? When you're only paying 1% of your what you're carrying, which is a great thing, and 2% on your No, I won't go on to that. We'll do that.
We'd be here a while.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Tanis, Garden of Kharid, plant power, thieving, anything coming out of the year on this? Because you're not much of a farmer type. This was my update, but, you know.
Well, but I would say this is on the short list for update of the year.
Jesus!
The thieving for me was a perfect update because, to get that kind of an XP rate, you do have to do it just right. You do it perfect. But that is kind of like what I look at as the skilling side of, you know, high-level PVM, right? Like, I've done the quest to get the stuff, to do the thing, to, you know, get those rates just right. But at the same time, more importantly, I see it as one of the biggest quality of life updates to come to that skill probably ever.
Yeah.
Next drift.
That's opening our eyes to what it could be, is what we'll say.
That's right. It's a blueprint. It is a blueprint for what they should be looking at in the future.
Okay. All right. Garden of Kharid is definitely the skilling update of the year then. All right. And with that, we're gonna move on to combat right now. Last year, of course, combat in PVM was the focus of pretty much the entire year, so we dedicated an entire episode to that. This year, we have just a segment on combat and PVM, so we've rotated out from Questcaping to Parnassius, and now we're heading over to Thaxi to talk a little bit about the combat and PVM updates of the year. Welcome.
Hey, good to be back.
And we're not going to math people out. We did that when these updates already came out. So
if you want the math, go back for it. We're going to tell you the results of the math as briefly as we can, I think, here.
Yeah, I hope we get to take a victory dance around certain parts of the update. But nonetheless, we're going to start with something that Tanis was able to dive into and dove into a lot. And this was the Abyssal Slayer creatures of early, was it early February or early March? I feel like it was early March when we got the Abyss Slayer.
Was it March?
Around that time, late winter, for sure.
We got three new Slayer creatures, the Abyssal Savage, the Abyssal Beast, and the Abyssal Lord, located at first in the Sentistan Asylum, now, of course, in the Wilderness. Tanis, how did these impact your Slayer from a combat perspective? Difficult, easy?
Well, they were a true Slayer creature. I mean, these were what I want, what I expect. They weren't many bosses. They were just an appropriate slayer creature at that level. Except for when the Wildy came out, because those abyssal lords out there are not good when your threat goes
surprise.
Up. Surprise! Yeah,
big, nasty surprise.
Yeah, you think you got a bunch of savages and some beasts around you, next thing you know, there's lords pop up like, yo, you're on my block. Yeah, man, I'm sorry.
Savages, beasts, and lords. Why did we go with that for the title of that episode? Anyways.
I'm telling you.
Oh, boy.
We just came out of Clip Show, and you guys wanted the BDSM title for that. But anyways, what do we got for savages here, Thaxi?
I mean, just drop slides, right? So we're looking at how changes in the meta this year is the focus of our segment. So the drop from the savages is the Abyssal Flesh. Of all of the updates, I'm going to say, for PVM this year, I think this is one of the most things that's been most slept on. These can be used to make armor spikes. These armor spikes apply the Abyssal Parasite damage over time, which is also applied by the whip we'll talk about in a second. Just in general, it's just an extra dot for melee, which, if you're using the helm, we'll talk about in a second, it gives you extra adrenaline back. It's just extra damage. It's extra chances to proc poison. And these really should be used anytime you're using melee. The problem with them is that they currently cost, 400 gold per armor spike. They effectively multiply the cost of armor spikes by like 9 times right now.
I remember we had a problem of finding enough flesh when this update came out to make it
usable.
And
that's the thing, is that they promised us that there would be more sources of flesh. And like, all right, well, they're planning a big elite dungeon type release. They're probably going to drop it there. And they didn't. And what that actually was is they're going to add more of these same creatures to the wilderness update. And what that's done is that it hasn't expanded the number of them being killed, because they're still only being killed for Slayer assignments, really. The flesh alone isn't quite worth killing them for, but it's like it gets used up too fast on those armor spikes to make it like viable to you. So it would be really strong. It has a great use case. But the price of it is low because nobody's using it. And nobody's using it because the price is still too high, even though it's low.
Right.
And so it's in this really weird place that I'm not a huge fan of. But they're great. You should be using them if you really want to ball out for your combat. These are fantastic. They only work on the melee style if you have melee weapons in both hands and your armor, top and bottom.
Go ahead, Tennis.
I was going to say, I mean, you can, if you're going to iron it, right? Like,
yeah, that's another option. You probably still have the supply issues, because you probably couldn't
kill enough,
right?
The problem with it is that you use them at Abyssals almost as fast as you can get them as drops. They need to be dropping at 2 or 3 times the rate to be like entering the economy even vaguely appropriately. Or they need to be dropping in large bundles from a boss or something similar. And they're just not. So hopefully that gets fixed in future.
But one thing
could be a boss-worthy drop.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Right? It is. No, it's a great, like, if they're looking
now. I think that's what you just.
I'm down. Yes, please.
Yeah, do it.
We've got so many good options for this,
and plenty of places to put them.
Send us to Infernus next year, right? Have us a quest list. Do something fun. Like, I'm super down. Those parasites infected Infernus. That's the whole, like, there's whole lore behind them. It would be great to dive into that, into the next storyline. So
that's really neat. That's really neat now that you mention it. But one thing we did jump up and down about was the helmet. From the Abyssal Beast, a tier 85 melee power armor helmet. Tell us about this, where this landed.
I mean, very simply, extra adrenaline for each melee ability bleed damage over time you have on a target. This is the thing, this fixed melee's problem with adrenaline, right? So you've got Hydrix bolts for range, you've got the critical strikes applying, giving you ulti back from Tsunami being cheap for magic. This gave melee a similar kind of adrenaline buff to remove their adrenaline issues. It still looks funny in my opinion, but I think it is, if I'm looking at all of the updates for this year in the combat section, I think this is the largest like power bump from a single item for almost any of them. There's some arguments to be made for some range changes, but this costs currently just under 10 million coins, and it massively changes how melee works.
It's friggin' from Slayer.
And it's from Slayer, which again, I love this. I love that it is a powerful item that is incredibly accessible. That is 10 out of 10 design work. Good job.
And it's a relatively common drop too, which is something and I have been moaning about for a while. So
yes,
there we go.
Big plan. Big fan.
And then what everybody wanted, the tier 92 whip, because, you know, back in the day, the tier 75 whip was iconic. It, of course, moved away from that because other powerful weapons came out. But now, if you go dual wield, there's a good whip option at tier 92 from a Slayer creature, yep. Nonetheless.
Every time you hit a target with this, it applies that parasite dot that's the same thing as from the Abyssal Flesh to your target, which that dot does count for getting adrenaline from the helm. So these things all pair really nicely together. It is, I think, still outdone by the Glacier Swords in terms of strength because of their passive effect and there being tier 95. But this is a great way to simplify your setup because you don't need to worry about those armor spikes for applying that bleed. And it doesn't break the bank at about 125 mil for a tier 92 weapon. That's awesome.
What do you pair that with, Pax? Like a Kopesh or something?
You would pair it with an offhand Kopesh, an offhand Drygor, an offhand... Honestly, you might be able to pull off the tier 85. I think the tier 85 offhand has its own
The cold cut
buff.
Offhand at tier 85,
the
right?
The cold cut, yeah, the Glacier offhand dagger. Might be an option, just kind of depends. I think all those you could make an argument for. Like, if you want to be really sweaty and you're trying to be endgame groups, make sure you're tier 90 plus because people are going to be angry at you for no particular reason. But again, the deal with this is that it's a nostalgia trip for the Abbey Whip, and I'm really not mad about that. Good job.
Yeah, and once again, Slayer, which is wonderful.
Yes. Well designed for every part of this update, except that flesh just really isn't dropping enough.
Yeah. And would you say that you would need the spikes even if you're using the whip?
No. No, so this they each add a stack. The stacks, I think, go up to like 50 times. They do increasing damage. But the biggest thing about this is that it adds a bleed. So effectively, every basic ability you do, if you have the whip on or your spikes activate on the target, every melee ability, basic ability you do gives you 2% extra adrenaline, which is just really nice.
I think that's one of the outstanding questions that I had in moving past this as well. And keep in mind, while this was happening, we were also running our micro lesson series, plug to youtube.com/RSBNB about building action bars, building what you'd take for Slayer and whatnot, right around the time these came out. So pair these with the Sentist and Asylum updates for a good time.
Have you ever seen, you're ever confused about what defensive items or skills you should be using, or when somebody posts that image into your Discord of like, this is my preset setup, and like, what are these five items? We talk through most of what that's going to be in that micro lesson section, about 5 minutes apiece. So if you need any of that, go take a listen.
And then we came to a patch note, and this was a March 14th Ninja Strike patch note on Tendrils, and that crit strikes are now part of the design rather than a bug because they were always critting. They also made them do more consistent damage, and I guess what my take on this is, you can give me yours, is that this just really solidified Magic's role as being what you use for the crit build.
I mean, yes, the other two styles are also critting, so this was a slightly larger buff for Magic than the others, because Magic is largely built around crits, and we'll talk about that when we get to the enchantments farther down. Generally speaking, I think these are more or less unchanged. They have always been within your top two or three strongest threshold options. It's just that you can't always sustain that HP cost, and this just cemented them as, if you can sustain the HP cost of these, they absolutely belong in your rotation, but maybe it's something you activate manually so that you don't accidentally
finish. Right. I might have been there before.
Fair enough. You don't want those on a revo bar. Smile.
I think I killed myself with them at the Abyssal Lords. I think that's what happened there.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Then we spent a good deal of time in the skilling section talking about accidental skilling, but this is where we got the Dine Arrows. We got raked over the coals for this, for trying to pass an opinion out before people got their hands on them. I think we were mostly right on these.
I'm standing by my guns on them for the most part. I think I passed early judgment on the full arrows, saying that 15% extra damage and minus 10% hit chance wasn't super useful. My comparison, of course, for all of these, so generally speaking, all of these arrows are about 3,000, 4,000 gold a piece right now, and there's a 1 in 3 chance that they're consumed on use. The comparison is splintering arrows, which also do a really strong damage, but cost about 700 gold, and are only consumed up to 13 times per phase of a boss or per creature. So, you know, for Slayer, these are about on par. Probably for like bossing and other use, they're probably a good bit more expensive. But the argument's here, right? You've got the Joss arrows, 30% extra damage, 20% hit chance to demons and dragons. If these work, they're the best. It's not a question. Just use them.
Places arrows, you're going to use these damage. Are... I'll just want to say the places you're going to use the Jazz arrows are the trash in ED4 and ED2 as a whole for the dragon side of it.
Yes. Yeah, and I mean, some things like QBD or KBD, if you wanted to really, like, you know, have some fun, mess around with it, right? Magic is also going to be more effective anyways a lot of these places, yeah. But, you know, we're not going to talk about that. Crit stick goes Bert. Full arrows are generally good, though. They are a strong option. That 15% extra damage does matter in places, especially where your targets are not poisonable or you're not using those splinter ring arrows, those kind of things, because a lot of the damage from those does come from the poison bleed that you get from the extra hit chance on them. Speaking of poison damage, though, the Bic arrows are the exact opposite of this. They're the if you can hit a target 200 times in a row without having 30 seconds that you can't hit it, these increase your poison damage that your target takes by a very massive margin. Just that 200 hit chance requirement means that you have there's very few places where you can really use them effectively. And I think we nailed that one on the head. The Wind Arrows, again, complicated ability management minigame with a big damage payout, but that complicated part of it is, like, and you'll see this with the bow ahead, too, is that if you can plan out a very precise rotation with these, much like with Despair Arrows that we talked about in the past, you can get really great mileage out of them, but as soon as that window, that rotation falls out the corner, becomes even more than like a tick or two off. If you miss an ability, if something happens you're not expecting, right, you have to move your character and that cancels an ability for a tick, whatever it is, that makes these arrows really fall off very hard. So the Wind abilities are very much a complicated, precise, like planned rotation minigame, which I think has a place and is a cool option. But generally speaking with these, all good options. They all have some niche use in the meta, but the Joss arrows and to a lesser extent the Full arrows I think really take the cake in terms of things that you're going to see used by the general player who isn't trying to score push a, you know, speed kill or, you know, do something that is like solo, a duo, you know, Solak or a really high enrage Glacier, right?
Yeah, and so. I think what we came to from places that we've gone is that you can mitigate the accuracy fall off of full at places like Yakka and whatnot to be able to use Jazz effectively and, you know, just get that little bit of extra out of your special attacks and whatnot. So
yeah, I mean, especially if you're using a tier 95, if you have tier 95 accuracy, or you're using a Hex Hunter bow with the extra accuracy, you're generally going to be hitting your hit chance on these regardless. So
all right, does that bring us to the bow of the Last Guardian that these arrows kind of foreshadowed what was coming with this?
Much like the Wind arrows, right? The bow of the Last Guardian, for it has a thing where you assume the special is always active, right? When the special is active and it doesn't have a cooldown, so it's always active, right? Every fourth time you hit the target with an on hit ranged ability damage ability, that the damage of that ability is added to an additional hit. So you effectively get 5 hits for the cost of 4. This secondary hit can apply poison, can apply bolt effects, can apply all these things. So all this stuff that range wants to do, where you're trying to hit the target as many times as possible to proc your bolts, to proc, well, in this case, your arrows, right? Whatever it is, like, this is going to do that for you. And I think what I was anticipating is that it's going to be really hard. Things that are like greater ricochet, where you're hitting the target like 7 times, or things like, it's going to be challenging to time that fourth ability hit to be a specifically large scale like snipe, or even something like snapshot, right? Where you're hitting the target with a big proc of damage every fourth specific hit, because range is just hitting the target so many times with rapid fire and Gricko and all these things. And I think if you can do that, if you can get used to saying, I'm going to hit the target this number of times because I just use this ability, this is going to put me at this many stacks, and because I have that many stacks, I am going to be using this ability and then this, so that I always, like, if you can do that mental math and those gymnastics in your head on the fly, you can get really solid, like, up to, I'm going to say about 40% extra damage out of the bow if you can consistently use that extra proc on a large damage hit.
But and we didn't know.
A lot of either practice or like just those mental gymnastics are crazy.
Yeah.
And you, if you can do that, this bow is really good at making you like play actively. And if you're not playing actively at all, I think our initial analysis stands there's about a 15% yep. damage increase, and that's yep. probably on par with what you're going to get out of a crossbow.
And we didn't know if people were going to use it or not, and we've seen some crazy things happen out of it,
right.
and we didn't anticipate that people would want to you know plan those tick-perfect ranged rotations, right?
Shout out to you, Lucario, and all the people like you. You know, that's the folks that are truly speed-killing. They're like, yeah, I can make this outperform the crit stick without having to rely on luck because it just hits like truck. You just have to be tick perfect for several minutes. So
that's not me.
No, it's not me either. But for the people that can do that, and you know, we think we talked about this too in pre-show. Those people are generally the people who are going to be able to afford the tier 95 bow. It's not all that accessible. It is still expensive. So, you know, the right people are ending up with this to make it really do work, and it's making it look great. So, kudos, you know?
Right, and then with
interesting
that...
Interesting design.
And then with that, we get to where this bow comes from, and that's the actual Zamorak boss fight in Elite Dungeon 4. And, you know, I really do want to go back at some point, but I don't want to sacrifice my high score spot right now. But I had a fun experience.
Gosh.
Hey, it's a high score spot.
You crazy human... It's a low score spot. Don't get this wrong. He's third from last currently at time of recording. I'm shaking mm-hmm. my head. I hope you can hear it through my microphone.
You do have to on. Try to be that bad.
No, I didn't try to be that bad, Tatis. It just happened.
Hey, it was release day. We didn't know what we were doing. It's fine.
27 minutes.
We are very proud.
I know. But I feel like... this didn't get enough coverage when we talked about it at first, and this was the boss for all players from story mode to normal mode to enrage mode, and I learned more about the thought processes and what went into this when we sat down with the mod Ramen behind the crown, which came out, I think, in the second last week in November, so by all means,
oh
go
gosh.
Back and listen to that. What?
That show was amazing. For anybody that
okay.
hasn't listened to that behind the crown, Ramen is, I mean... it's worth a listen. It was one of our better episodes recently, and that's, you know, I'm on a lot of those episodes, so there you go.
Okay,
that's my take on that.
All right. But the combination of an elite dungeon and the end game PVM boss isn't something we anticipated, and it took the learning experiences from the previous elite dungeons, Glacor, Telos, and all the other God Wars bosses, combined them together. Added the high score system with the enrage chase mechanic, or the yardstick measuring contest, as Tanis called it, and people are still setting records there. Also flipping things on its head for phase 7 with the rune mechanics, because, you know, we in our testing didn't go beyond that, so you kind of had to take a different perspective on that. So I'm glad we were able to get Bears on for that and get his perspective when that came out. And also, I think this is the start of changing how loot could potentially work in RuneScape. So overall, I think Zamorak is a good boss, and if you haven't done it yet, go out and do it at some point, even if it's just on story yep. mode or normal mode. So,
yep. And if it takes you 27 minutes.
That's right.
Or 49.
Yeah, that's what the third last has. David actually suggested that I make an account to try and beat that record. Take longer. So,
well, you do have an account now with combat levels.
I know.
I'm just saying it's an option. Good luck.
Elite Dungeon 4 also brought us enchantments for a number of items that have ramp up times behind them. How do you want to go through these? Because there were 9 of them in total.
Yeah, I think the first off, I want to make a note on cost. Right, so there's 3 melee, 3 range, 3 magic. The melee and range ones are all sitting 30 to 70 mil. The mage ones are sitting 130 to 200 mil, right? That gives you an idea of what people are, you know, consuming at the higher end, and also makes a note that the items required for the mage ones, just mage upgrades in general, are a little more expensive. So just a note on if your style is mage right now, these may be more challenging for you to acquire. But with that said, there's 3 general brands of these, right? It's upgrades to the Rex Matriarch rings of that style, the gloves that drop for that style, so Gloves of Passage, Carapax wrist straps, and the Nightmare Gauntlets. And then it's an upgrade to the style-specific weapons, so the Hex Hunter, Terra Maul, and Inquisitor Staff. The style-specific weapons are the simplest part. They deal 5% more damage when their effect is active. It goes from 12.5% damage boost to a 17.5% damage boost. Lovely. Generally useful. If you use those weapons, pick them up. Those enchantments tend to be one of the cheaper ones. The glove and ring effects are a little more general, but they generally improve the effect of that style, and they, like, my take on these is they really cemented into place the playstyle that was being kind of brought into light for each of these things. So, right, like, the glove effects are generally, like, they do a little more damage, they're a little more effective, whatever it is. The ring effects in particular, though, things like the melee damage, you get extra critical damage done for each bleed you have on your target. So again, putting melee off is that, like, bleeds are going to benefit you for this style. The magic ring, for every channeled, when you have a channeled ability done, it increases your critical strike chance and critical strike damage. Sorry, just the damage. The strike chance was already on the ring. So it very much makes the, like, hey, magic is a style. The crit stick is the weapon that's here to stay. Critical strikes are important to magic. Here's critical strike damage for your ring, right? And they very much locked that into place. If you can afford these are still great upgrades to have. And there's not a whole lot else to honestly say about them as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, and just remember the ramp-up time, apparently. That's something that is a major factor in many of the people who are considering this.
You cannot use them as switches.
These
effects are only active when you have them stuck on your finger for a few seconds.
Yeah. That's a good way of putting it. And then we came to things like Greater Sunshine and Greater Death Swiftness that came in the form of codices that upgrade those abilities to have the extended planted feet effect without needing a switch. And it also brings back the AoE, small AoE available for each of those. Not much to write home about those, just a nice quality of life fix. I'm personally still using my switches. You?
Yep. I'm also using my switch. I'm not willing to. I actually did buy one of the codices and I ended up selling it back. I want to say it was about 280 mil at the time. Like, they're nice, but it is primary quality of life switchscape, right? The damage buff you get out of this is pretty small, right? Like, it makes Sunshine more effective at killing the final phase of hard mode Zilliana. Like, that is the congratulations. That's that's the mechanical change. Because your Sunshine will still be active when she respawns. Like, it is niche like that. That is how much these are actually going to improve your combat abilities.
Right, but if the price didn't come down, it would be something that Tannis would want from the accessibility angle.
Oh, I mean, it's something I would want from the accessibility. Like, cleaning up my inventory, having fewer switches, is fantastic for everybody. And endgame PVMers are willing to pay out the butt for it, unfortunately, which makes folks that want it for accessibility reasons less accessible. Again, I would love it if this dropped a little more often, or was just something that, like, this would have been a good quest reward as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, and that's been a theme of this year in review so far.
It is worth noting on these that they do require a very large number of the components that make the planet feet perk, so the Hellware components, so that the Hellware boss drops didn't completely lose all value in these.
Right, so the world 66 nuts will still be able to make their money.
The folks who are farming that, indeed. But yeah, that's all I got for that one.
We also had Chaos Roar does a bit of ability damage, 20 to 130%, and it doubles the base damage of the next melee hit. If you're doing a channeled ability, only doubles the first hit on that. And once again, synergies, melee, huge hits go boom.
Yeah, and I remember when we talked about this on the show, like, our analysts, we were all generally saying we like this because it rewards things like even the basic abilities, right? Those weak 3-second basic abilities, they do extra damage if your target is stunned. It is adding stuff like that that's saying you use this ability and then that ability will do more damage. And it is just same thing. I think the melee gloves do the same thing. The gloves of passage, where it's. And actually the Carapace Crewshops too. Like, it's you do something and then you do something else and it rewards you for having those actions in order. Which just, like, the more you're paying attention to your combat, the more you're going to be rewarded for that. It adds kind of that extra value without necessarily being, like, mandatory to do so. It's just, like, if you want to spend 600 mil on this upgrade, you can have a more active combat style and be more rewarded for it. And I like that. I like that trend of a reward space.
Yeah, and to me, that's what makes
it more dynamic. Like
yeah, makes it interesting, and it's one of my favorite things about RS Combat, believe it or not. And then with this, we move to the Vestments of Havoc, tier 95 melee power armor with a tier 100 damage boost and only a tier 75 armor rating, which cemented the melee playstyle of being a glass cannon.
What's that? You're wearing a full suit of armor? No, you're not. You're not a tank. That's not melee. No. Magic armor. Robes are the tank armor. Ah, crazy. Yeah, so the big thing with these, right, is that they were tier 100 damage boost, which is nice, but in terms of like what that gives you, that's a little less important than the set effects on them, which the set effects are pretty large, right? So again, remember, the two-piece gives you adrenaline after ultimates. It's nice. It's not going to change the world or break the bank. The four-piece, we're going to skip the three-piece. The four-piece adds 20% max adrenaline, which is, again, nice, but like not going to break the bank. And again, four-piece does require you that you wear the helm from this set, which effectively means you cannot wear your Jaws of the Abyss, which is kind of not an option where we're currently at. Mm-hmm. So helm's useless. Whoops. Would be better as gloves, as an option for the Gloves of Passage. The boots are also not always used because laceration boots, side the point. The three-piece bonus on this is the big winner. This is the hugest, the crazy change from this. It extends Berserk by 6 seconds. Berserk has a base time of 20 seconds, unlike Sunshine or Death Swiftness, which have a base time of 38 seconds, assuming you have the perk, right? So it's the difference of, like, you're adding, like, 30% duration to this ultimate, which doubles your damage output. It also, again, gives you that adrenaline back after you use an ultimate so that you get that extra threshold. It effectively gives you adrenaline for a free threshold during your Berserk, as well as 6 seconds in which to use an extra threshold or two. At the end of your Berserk, when you're already, like, once you've already built your adrenaline back up, this is a huge buff to the amount of damage you can get off during a Berserk rotation, and makes a huge difference in melee's ability to put out that burst damage that the style used to be known for back before, you know, the crit stick go burn.
Right. Okay.
Melee used to be the style that, you know, other than some very niche, very specific combinations with ranged weapons, melee was your burst set up for 20 to 30 second short burst because Berserk was so powerful. Extending Berserk out a bit gives some of that power back to melee. So these are the best melee armor right now. Sorry, it's your masterwork. But these are a great buff.
It's this combination with the vestments and some of the other things that we've talked about that would really make me like to invest in a melee set, but right. I just don't want to do the switchscape for all the different weapons on it. But and part of the reason that comes into play is one of the final combat updates of the year that we got was the buffs to the dragon special attacks. We're not going to go too much into these. We're just going to kind of summarize the best single target, the best stats boosters, and the best AoE abilities on there. So
yes, without any numbers whatsoever, if you want numbers and the reasons behind any of this, we did a lovely, you know, 30-minute long dive into how these should be used in the episode on them just a few weeks ago. Very briefly, the mace, if you're a low-leveled player, the mace is your most consistent damage choice. Use it whenever you have other thresholds off cooldown because lower levels often have extra adrenaline. Use this instead of an ultimate. The longsword is the hardest hitting special attack. It's inconsistent, but it gives really fun looking numbers. The dagger gives the same damage as the long, but it has two chances to activate poison. It has higher accuracy and lower variability between its min and max hits, so the damage is your better option than the longsword overall. People need to stop using the longsword. It drives me up the wall. The claws are a huge burst. They have really complicated math, but just trust me when I say that they are the best single target option. They are slightly consistent damage because their damage is skewed towards the upper end of what it could be because all the low damage options are kind of eschewed away by the math. They are a bit more pricey if you were going to be changing items in and out and in and out of an essence of finality if you're a higher level player who wants to use these. That's our single target setup. For our stat boosting options, we've got three things, right? So the Battle Axe, unchanged, provides a huge damage done buff. If you use this in combination with the relic power that was changed with this too, the Enduring Rage, whatever it is, the tier level 96 archaeology relic that gives you adrenaline now, you can use this with the battle axe and it will give you a nice boost to mining, right? Because it boosts your strength level if you're not using an overload. So there's that. The scimitar increases hit chance with slash attacks by 25%. Great thing for lower level players who are not hitting the cap on accuracy. That 25% for 1 minute, super easy to apply. Like, big fan of this for lower level players especially. Hatchet raises target affinity by 3%. Really nice for Iron Men who don't have access to a Stadius Warhammer. Generally, just good changes. AoE options, the Dragon Halberd and the Dragon Two-Hand. Dragon Halberd and Two-Hand have relatively similar damage. Dragon Halberd costs less and hits in a cone in front of you. Two-Hand does even more damage than that, costs a lot of adrenaline, but hits in a 5x5, or if you're wielding a Halberd range weapon like a Scythe, so if you have to have this in essence of Phenology to do this, it hits in a 7x7, so you can effectively nuke an entire room with the Dragon Two-Hand. We are big fans of this here. It is a lot of fun. And was very broken in Shattered Worlds, so
so much so they had to hotfix it.
But really, really cool, really fun, like big damage me like, very accessible, right? None of these drops are super rare. They're all like things that Joe Schmo can go and play around with. So the only, you know, some of these setups do require Essence of Finality, which is a little bit of a money like barrier, but generally speaking, you could grind that for that yourself. I'm just a fan of these changes overall, and I hope we get something that's similar for a lot of other kind of underutilized special attacks.
Yeah, and you know, overall, dragon weapons were always special, and it's good, and it's a good spot to end the year with on that. Tanis, you have any questions or anything else combat-wise, special attack-wise from the dragon items or anything?
No, I just I'm kind of glad I'm going through Slayer again, because even though a lot of these toys are, you know, for bossing or whatever, I look at them and go, ooh, that'd be fun.
Yeah,
well, I want to play some of that.
Yeah, and I feel like that's where we were at in general with combat this year. Not as much as we had in the previous year, but hey, at the end of the day, some pretty wholesome changes as we had for pretty much well, I think all the combat styles got something, but definitely most ranged and melee this year is going to be how we end this. And you know, with that brings us to the end of our year in review special. And Tanis and I talked about this at the end, about whether we were going to do two picks of the year or whether it was going to be unanimous pick of the year, and we settled on the unanimous pick of the year.
It was unanimous.
Take it away.
All right. So the number, or the pick of the year, the unanimous pick of the year is a Star Trek show called Strange New Worlds. Me and Shane watched like every episode as they came out. It was quintessential classic Star Trek with a modern feel. It was like RuneScape in that way, right? It had the nostalgia blankets you love, but with a nice new wrap and just, you know, characters that were compelling. One of the best captains, I think, in any series for me, Captain Pike. Just everybody. It's so memorable. And even the people that I was like, please don't screw it up, because it was young versions of such beloved characters, and they nailed it. I'm like, this is great.
Yeah, and there was no question with this. I would have went with that for pick of the year, so I'm glad that we were able to work that in. Normally we work that in at the end of Clip Show, but I figured that works better at the end of a year in review. So once again, that was pick of the year. Definitely go watch Strange New Worlds if you're a Star Trek fan. And hey, if you're not, it's a good one to jump onto, because it's non-serialized compared to others like Discovery and Picard. But just, of course, an update on where we're at show scheduling-wise. Next week, you'll be hearing the Clip Show. Tanis and I have already recorded that. That was an adventure, just to put it mildly.
Uh-huh. Yep. It's like a locker room around here.
Oh boy. This is, oh boy.
That's a way to put it. And then the week after that, we'll be sitting down with Mod Jack to discuss RuneScape's endgame, amongst other things, where he sees that. Sirion and I had that conversation with him, and we'll get that out for the first show of the new year. But with that, you're probably wondering, how can I get these podcasts delivered automatically to you? Well, you can subscribe. We're on any number of podcast listeners out there. We're on Apple Podcasts, Google, Pocket Cast, Spotify, Amazon for your A&E Amazon devices that I won't say the name of right now. We're also on Stitcher. And of course, we also post video versions of the podcast as well on YouTube at youtube.com/RSBNB. And of course, being a YouTube channel, if you like the podcast or you just like one of the episodes, like and subscribe. It greatly helps the channel out. With that being said, everybody have a wonderful holiday season. Merry Christmas to everybody. And we'll see you for the next set of shows that we have lined up. Take care, everyone. See you then.
See ya.
Ciao.